featuring Florence and the Machine.
Welcome to our Florence and the Machine session.
Go to bbc.co.uk/introducing.
This is, in fact, UBC. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, starting the end of the world news 18 minutes late. The end of the world will be 18 minutes late this morning. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Build a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I build a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a I build a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and line. Once I build a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Love take, baby. Do I like what you like? I could be wholesome, I could be loathsome, guess I'm a little bit shy. Why don't you like me? Why don't you like me without making me try? I try to be like Chris Kelly, but all the looks were too sad. So I tried a little Freddy. I've got an entity. So I tried it, little Freddy. I've got an answer to him.
That lovely piece of super Euro pop was brought to you by the end of the world news. It was a young chap called Mika. And yes, I know there's pure pop, but he gets to the playlist for channeling Freddie Mercury and Wham. Very 1980s, very lovely, hearkening back to a sweeter, lovelier time before the new Great Depression. Brother, can you spare a dime? This is the end of the world news, CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
are also able to tell other persons our ideas and feelings through colors. Through colors. Through colors.
Oh, I say, something went terribly, terribly wrong there. That was a moment from the Pinker Tones, the Pinker Tones. And here we will have another moment from the Pinker Tones, who I believe are from Mexico. The Pinker Tones. Ay, caramba!
We'll be right back. I say.
Now we will take a trip back to the 1980s when German punk was king. Here is Nina Hagen, so from 1980.
Right, and this is the Wild Bunch, innit?
The purpose of this record...
Right, that was the Wild Bunch, isn't it? It's the Wild Bunch. That's from, like, Bristol, from the Bristol Sound, before it all turned into... Oh, no, that's not Bristol, my lover. I'm sorry, my Rose. This be the Bristol Sound. This before Massive Attack come along. They were called a little group called the Wild Bunch, and they used to get on their turntables and play some parties. And there's some from the 1980s, and God knows what's coming next. But I'm sure it's going to be good, because this is the end of the world news.
Ballu kobla la aino chish eredale batish sankano deretish melkishis agenet sobekum gedainish melkishis agenet sobekum gedainish Inku almas nesh Ethiopia wit loga hulu yadenekesh kakolas kedega yihew yetilishin enchi metasebia simish no kengidih wezerit Ethiopia simish no kengidih Where's the rit Ethiopia? Kazish lomi birtu kan no gunchish sagrish ya beselom mekano angetish tutochish menderin yaskom jinnet yalesh
Inken ele lebiş kök oncoç belaynış Inken ele lebiş kök oncoç belaynış
The return of the Pinkertones. Consider this just the latest salvo in DJ Goulash's evil plan to get the world dancing. Dancing and dancing. 2,000 years and still dancing.
This is the house that Funk built. Groove Armada style.
What could happen if this fell into the wrong bottoms?
En la naturaleza, usted logra el sonido total en todas sus dimensiones. No hay duda, los sonidos existen en el espacio. Así. Usted logra el sonido total, en todas sus dimensiones. Sonido total, no hay duda, los sonidos existen así.
The lunatics have taken over the asylum. Adam's gone for a tinkle, and he asked me to press this button.
Lamb in the face of death on the masthead. Hold your breath through late break and disaster. Makes the news of the trash. Codes, feelings, mental, global, like coke in the nose of the nobles, keeps it alive. Wrath, riots, and the race is on fire,
in the music tanks with no red lights in sight. Got you
Yo, yo, that was something new from, what are they called? Like TV on the Radio. I like that name, TV on the Radio, because like their sound is so dense, it's like you're watching TV, except it's on the radio. So grab your TV dinner. Here's some more things from New York. This is the Brazilian Girls. They're called that because they shave themselves, except for a little line straight up the middle. That's not the Brazilian Girls, that's Graham. But this is the Brazilian Girls. Hold on to your wigs. We'll be right back.
Europe's big four get ready to debate the global financial crisis. But is a coordinated approach too late? And the alternative to putting your money in the bank?
Thought by a small amount of gold as a small private investor, in the hope that if stocks and shares continue to plummet, then gold might be rising.
Those stories and lots more coming up on Europe Today, all after a roundup of the day's main news.
BBC News with Stuart McIntosh. Britain's top police officer, Sir Ian Blair, has announced his resignation. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, said she'd reluctantly accepted his resignation. Sir Ian Blair has been under fire on several fronts, notably over the killing of a Brazilian man shot dead by officers who mistook him for a terrorist in July 2005. In a statement, Sir Ian said the new Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, had asked that he should go.
At a meeting yesterday, the new Mayor made clear, in a very pleasant but determined way, that he wished there to be a change of leadership at the Met. I understand that to serve effectively, the Commissioner must have the confidence of both the Mayor and the Home Secretary. Without the Mayor's backing, I do not consider that I can continue in the job.
As the news just in, the Mayor of London, Boris Johnston, said he was sure Sir Ian had done the right thing and had made a lasting contribution to policing in London. He said Sir Ian's resignation was an opportunity for a clean break and a new start. The US House of Representatives is meeting in Washington shortly to debate President Bush's multi-billion dollar rescue plan for America's financial sector. The Senate has already approved a revised version of the plan. Mr. Bush has been meeting American business leaders to discuss his plan. From Washington, Rajini Vaidyanathan reports.
President Bush is calling on business leaders to make the case for his $700 billion rescue package, urging that people's jobs are in jeopardy if action isn't taken. All this is designed to place further pressure on those members of the House of Representatives who voted the bill down on Monday. Those backing it hope that the amendments, including extra tax breaks for ordinary Americans and more protection for savings accounts, will make it more palatable to the Republicans and Democrats who opposed it.
Pakistan has said it wants a deal on nuclear cooperation with the United States, similar to the one that the Senate in Washington has just approved with India. For the first time in decades, American companies will be able to take advantage of the lifting of an export ban to sell Delhi nuclear fuel and technology. Barbara Plett reports.
Pakistan developed its atomic weapons program to counter the alleged nuclear threat from India, its regional rival. So it's been very concerned by proposed U.S. support for India's civilian nuclear program. Now that the deal's been passed, the Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani says there must be no discrimination. He told reporters Pakistan would be justified to ask for a similar agreement and should be accommodated. However, Washington has already indicated that Pakistan's track record of nuclear proliferation disqualifies it from such an arrangement. Newspaper reports here have suggested that Pakistan's leaders might turn to China for help with civilian nuclear technology.
You're listening to the World News coming to you from the BBC.
Oh, no, you bloody aren't. This here is the end of the world news coming to you from Vancouver, British Columbia. Good morning, Graham. What's happening?
Adam, good morning.
Good morning. So here we are.
And you're all tinkly fresh?
I'm tinkly fresh and covered in little jam and jelly stains.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, delicately placed there by my two-year-old bumble of joy.
Oh.
So here we are in the morning after the worst week of the century so far, if you happen to be a rich guy. The worst week of the century so far isn't going to hit us poor folks for another year or so until the trickle-down effect starts really trickling down.
Yeah, I heard an eminent economist poo-pooing the trickle-down effect, saying it never worked in the first place.
Yeah, well,
and everybody down there knew that already, but you know, he from up on high decided to put his imprimatur on that notion.
Yeah, here's a little thing from The Guardian. This is a week ago now, but nonetheless, it says, what happened on September 11th, 2001? Remember that? Mm. And what has happened since? The Twin Towers, history, but it's still history that we don't understand very well.
Reactions at the time ran from apocalyptic to dismissive. Everything either would soon be back to normal, everything's fine, or nothing is ever going to be the same again. Well, 7 years later, probably both things are true. Things did go back to normal, if by normal you include the casualty list from Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course the list from the terrorist attacks in Madrid, London, Bali, and elsewhere. Horrors are just another part of the jangled wallpaper of our life. They've kind of disappeared into the background. We're so used to hearing about suicide bombings or pregnant ladies blowing themselves up or what have you that we just kind of turn the page. We're not even reading it anymore. A few terrorist attempts have been successful, but almost all have been incompetent over the last 7 years.
Well, that's in the United States. But if you sort of think about things blowing, yes,
and Europe. However, there's a big crater in front of a hotel in Pakistan.
But even with that in mind, just think of the equivalent to explosions. You know, last week the Hyatt Hotel in Islamabad. It was an unbelievable number of casualties.
And a huge crater. I mean, that was one heck of a bomb. Yeah,
400 kilograms of C4 or whatever, which is just rattling windows 4 miles away.
I guess what this is speaking to is the idea that we had to fight a war on terror abroad or it would come home, and that really what we were doing was defending the homeland. So I guess this is speaking to the concept of homeland defense. In any case, it carries on to say that many things have been incompetent in terms of terrorist attacks on the Western world. So there are two curves on the graph. One is the curve of the terrorist competence. The other is the curve of our own competence, not just in the narrow sense of defending ourselves, but I make little bunny ears in front of the microphone when I say that, but also in changing the world in such a way that our enemies also change and embrace perhaps less vicious ways of trying to achieve what they want. Two bad wars, a third one brewing, abrogations of law and civil liberties that were completely deplorable, and they've also been totally ineffective. We've alienated minorities in many countries, and a relationship between the West and the Muslim world is marked by misunderstanding. Partly the problem is that if you call it a war, then you think of people in uniform as being the solution. John McCain seems locked into this monolithic view of ultimate military victory. Funnily enough, engagement with terrorism is not a war. It's more important than that. and while we've been engaging militarily with terrorism, which of course is an impossibility, the bankers have been making hay at home until we found out that they were all crooks. And confidence has collapsed.
The masters of the universe, the smartest guys in the room, self-described, ain't as smart anymore. Well, you know, same group, same ilk.
Yeah, George really was so as smart. Dumb as he looked, huh?
No, it's quite amazing how they're all, you know, any amount of the press is really looking forward to the perp walks. They figure some element is criminal. And the very least, there are a whole bunch of incompetent, greedy people out on the streets now, you know, going, geez, I wonder where my next job's coming from with $1.2 million bonuses for being some mid-level trader somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable, these sort of amounts of money. And this is, of course, why Main Street, by a ratio of somewhere between 200 and 501, was phoning all its congressional leaders last week during the first vote in Congress to, the so-called $700 billion Wall Street bailout. They were saying, no, this is just, you're just bailing out all the rich guys. What about us? What about the people who are, you know, really hurting and have been hurting for a whole long time, who never had the luxury of losing millions of dollars because we never had it in the first place?
Well, I've been reading a fair amount of thought and analysis on this in order to try to understand what's going on in
this
economic crisis.
You need more than my thought and analysis?
And ever more, you know? And let's keep the conversation going, because, I mean, if we get too simplistic, then we're lost, because the system is deliberately complex. And I think one of the reasons it's become a private club for only fat cats is that they're using a mathematical code that you have to go to certain universities to understand. You've got to take the time to learn the stuff, right? And we can't just knee-jerk and expect to understand what's going on.
Well, opaque, and some would argue that it's a Ponzi scheme.
Indeed, that it's necessarily opaque and in a secret language in order that only a certain section of the population understands enough to make money off it. And I'd like to talk about that because Warren Buffett has just done something very interesting. But before I get to that, I want to cover this from the New York Times. This is from today's New York Times, in fact. Lesson from the crisis. When trust vanishes, that's when you worry. And I think that's exactly what's happened, is that really... We've watched trust in our leadership, and both in Canada and in the States and in England, dissipate ever since 2001. We felt lied to as a population, and at first it was only the intellectual elite and radical liberal media who was calling foul when, after 2001, people started saying, well, the world has changed, and now we can bomb whoever we want. Nobody even questions what we're doing in Afghanistan. Originally, we were there to rout the Taliban and find bin Laden, neither of which are now seem to be what we're doing in there. But we're still there, and we're not questioning it. But what happened is we lost faith in our leaders, to tell the truth, and everybody kind of shrugged and went, well, you know, we all knew they lied anyway and pretended it wasn't going to make any difference. But over a large period of time, it makes a huge amount of difference. The trust is gone, and as a result, the whole monetary system, which is based on, I will lend you money and you will make me promises, and I know that you're good on those promises, no longer works. It no longer functions. Credit is no longer available because trust is no longer available, and it really is almost that simple.
Well, speaking to the opaqueness of it, and then those loans, many of them very bad with no money down, et cetera, thus the foreclosure crisis, the one of the many aspects of the overall sort of maelstrom, is that these loans were packaged up and sent off to places like Belgium and England and Iceland, you know, to banks there.
Traded all over
and
the world.
And then turned into you know, these various bits of supposed equity, which were then funneled back, you know, again, speaking to the opaqueness of it, back into mutual funds, and it looked as though it was a great credit risk, but really, because, again, you know, you're talking in terms of only a very few people at the top even kind of half knew what was going on, that down the line a few steps, you know, they got a bunch of AAA credit rated options, you know, buying debt, which means, you know, you have the right to collect the interest plus principal on that instrument. But it's four steps removed from, you know, where it originally was, which was, you know, you go to your local bank and you get your mortgage. But these things are just, they've been whipped around the world at the speed of electrons, and nobody understands.
I think with a single purpose, and the single purpose in the States amongst Bush and the smartest guys in the room has been to get profit for rich guys, while the risk is entirely taken up by the American taxpayer. And that's what's now playing out, is since it's tumbled down, the rich guys are saying, well, you see, we're getting no profit, but we can't afford the risk. And that's what's being picked up by the American taxpayer.
And the formerly smart guys who were formerly rich, there was no downside risk to their jobs. So because they made money, the more of these instruments they were able to sell, swap, package up, and deliver to somebody else. So they made their little crumbs, you know, that fell off because they were the guys who were handling the transactions. And there was no downside risk. I mean, these guys are the CEOs and stuff. They're walking away with these immense bonuses. And yet, if the company loses money, which has happened many times lately, not just in the last few months, but over the last few years, and these guys are still walking away with millions. And you know, you look up from Main Street and you go, what's wrong here?
One of the arguments right now going on in the House of Representatives in trying to pass this bailout bill is the reduction of the golden handshakes that are being given to the CEOs of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who have just completed one of the biggest scams in history and are walking away with bonuses. And that's one of the things that they're now arguing about removing, that the Bushies are calling unpatriotic to even question this bill when America needs you. But before we start shaking our fists in glee, which I must admit I'm liable to lead the cheer here, I just want to read this little piece of sobering news. In 1929, Meyer Mishkin owned a shop in New York, sold silk shirts to working men. The stock market
market crashed that October, he turned to his son, who was a college student at City College, offered a version of his sentiment. It said, "It serves those rich bastards right." A year later, as Wall Street's problems were starting to spill into the broader economy, Mr. Mishkin's store went out of business because he no longer had enough customers. His son went to work to support the family. Mr. Mishkin never had a steady job again. Now, Frederick Mishkin, Meyer's grandson, until he stepped down a month ago, an ally of Ben Bernanke's on the Federal Reserve Board. He told this story the other day. The moral is obvious. Many people in Washington fear that the country is starting to spiral into a terrible turndown, perhaps the whole world. And to their horror, the public and members of Congress turning into modern-day Meyer Mishkins, more interested in punishing Wall Street than saving the economy. So we're all shaking our hands and say, sirs, the rich bastard's right. But all of that may be true. But there's good reason for public skepticism, but experts and policymakers so desperately want to take action have failed to tell a compelling story about why they're so afraid. It's not enough to say that the markets could freeze up, loans could become impossible to get, the economy could slide into its worst downturn since the Great Depression. For now, the crisis has little effect on most Americans beyond, the news.
Parenthetically, I have heard differently. I've heard that it is trickling down very nastily, because credit is freezing up, so so people can't buy inventory.
But what we now need to understand is that A is going to lead to B is going to lead to C, and that just pulling down the rich bastards will not be without personal cost to the little guys, the trickle-down effect.
Maybe we needed those rich guys in the first place. Is that what you're saying? Yes, it sounds like that is what you're saying.
No, that's not what I'm saying. But just because what's been going on is evil does not mean that doing nothing and watching them suffer is going to be a good solution for us or for them.
That's a little entertainment for a few days.
It's a little entertainment for a few days, but then it's going to be 10 years of joblessness is the fear. Because we have to kind of understand that our entire economy has been running on debt. It's been running on the ability to raise money quickly so that you can start a business. And if you can't raise the money, you can't start the business. And if you can't start the business, and our dear co-host, Brother Goulash, knows this. In an attempt to run a business in a world that was dominated by Walmart, where he, as a small-time producer, could not cut his costs low enough to compete with factories in China and, the huge bulk that Walmart wanted to sell things at. But something else has happened that I thought was fascinating. And this is maybe a little glimmer below the curtain. Warren Buffett, who's one of the rich guys in the world, one of the extreme rich guys in the world, and has always painted himself as the friend of the people, the straight shooter, the guy who plays
lives
it
in the
straight.
Same house in Oklahoma for 60 years or something.
Uh-huh. And never invited me over.
No.
He's just bought the bluest of blue chip companies at a very steep discount. And this is the interesting bit. He's buying $3 billion in perpetual preferred stock from General Electric. By perpetual and preferred, it means if you get the idea of, wow, if Buffett's borrowing General Electric, I am too. Well, forget about it, because he gets a way better deal than you do. Mm-hmm. General Electric, the conglomerate, is seeking to allay concerns about its financial health by raising a whole bunch of new cash. $12 billion, to be precise, General Electric needs in liquidity. It's the latest investment move from Mr. Buffett. He just bought $5 billion in perpetual preferred stock in Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Shares in GE, long considered a bellwether because of its broad range of businesses, have fallen 42% this year amid the company is too big. Now, what does this mean? GE is the symbol of American business to the world, Mr. Buffett said in a statement. I've been a friend and admirer of GE and its leaders for decades. In other words, I play golf with the fuckers. They have strong global brands and businesses with which I'm quite familiar. I'm confident that General Electric will continue to be successful in years to come. He's probably right, but then you have to look at, holy cow, what kind of deal is General Electric giving this guy to sell stock, and why are they doing it? They're trying to raise cash quickly, and that means that they don't have as much money as they've pretended to have. And then you read the blogs underneath this article in the New York Times, and that's when it gets really interesting. First one says, the vultures are circling, yeah? Because now's the time to buy. Buy, buy, everything's cheap, fire sale. And somebody else writes, thank God, it's the only American company left. We need their products. Thanks, Warren, for having the faith. Right? So there are a lot of blogs here.
So there's somebody who drank the Kool-Aid a long time ago.
A lot of blogs here who say Warren Buffett is a genuine patriotic American and thanks for buying American. And then there's...
As if he's really risking anything, aside from, you know, even if it sounds like a lot of money, $3 billion, $5 billion, in the end... He's really not risking anything compared to the guy who's about to lose his house. I mean, I always sort of come back to that really, you know, deeply true psychological aspect of the difference between rich guys losing some money and poor guys losing some money is astronomical in terms of the psychology. And I was to speak to this, and sorry, I'm entering into a new parenthesis here. I wanted to speak to this because rich people get rich when things go bad. A guy like Warren Buffett, he can go and, quotations, risk $3 or $5 billion at, and then you say that these instruments are very preferred, et cetera, perpetual preferred, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just adds to my point that they're there, as you say, the vultures are going to circle, they're going to swoop in, they're going to grab. With, you know, companies like GE clearly are going to survive, and you know, a year or two from now, that company is going to have a 42%. You know, it's going to be back to where it was last year or whatever it is.
Maybe because they're one of the big companies involved in armaments manufacturing. Business as usual.
Yeah. Lost in all the hubbub was that because
they also own CSNBC.
Yeah. Well, that's where it gets into that big mutual weenie pull that I always talk about. But
even when
$62 billion allotment to the military, which was basically just lost. It was way back on Section K, you know, K4. You know, we got to give another $62 billion to the military. You know, and it just is completely gone because, you know, people are worried about other things.
Well, it's keeping General Electric going, apart from anything else. Here's another post. This is Larry from New York City, says that General Electric would grant such favorable terms to Warren Buffett can only be taken as admission of the depth of their problems. Yeah. Berkshire Hathaway gets a guaranteed 10% dividend plus the option to buy shares at a deep discount in the future. I shudder to think what this means for GE's financial services division and for the common shareholders. Because, of course, what they're doing is they're diluting the shares by about 6 or 7%. So by raising another $12 billion off the back of Warren Buffett, every shareholder in General Electric is having his share reduced by, it's like having a 5% corner just ripped off the share and resold to Warren Buffett by diluting the share.
And you're saying by a 10% dividend, that means he automatically makes 10% on his money.
Yes,
and
that's as a dividend. As a dividend. Yeah. He keeps the shares, gets 10% return per annum. And there's another blogger here who's done the math, who says this isn't 10%. This is somewhere between 10% and 90% when you actually have a look at what's going on. Let's take this caller and see what they have to say. I'm sure they're going to tell us it doesn't matter. The world is coming to an end anyway. Hey, caller, are you there?
Yeah, caller, I'm here.
Hey, what's up, Marion?
He's one of the guys who's made all kinds of money.
I listened last night. There was a woman that she used to do the audit for all this. Big banks and companies, and she's saying one thing, that's the $59 billion that the Pentagon can't account for. And all the papers that were kind of tracing this money were in one of the buildings in the U.S. that was blown up, and I forgot the name of the place.
A building was blown up full of money?
The same, you know, in Pentagon where the supposedly plane flew in. That's exactly where most of the papers were as well, so...
They were holding $59 billion at the Pentagon when it got blown up?
No. They can't really account for this money. But, you know, they say the papers were there, but, you know, they were blown.
Oh, I see.
The records have been mysteriously destroyed.
Yeah, so there you have it.
Interesting. You know where I bet it's gone to? I bet it's gone to Anbar province, because another thing has happened, which is the Americans have managed to pull their army out of Anbar province, which was the big Sunni stronghold where all Al-Qaeda in Iraq was coming from. And they're saying, you see, now they're our friends because we enlisted the Sunnis to become part of us.
Well,
I think they bought
them.
I think basically we bought the terrorists onto our side for as long as we're there, and rather than fight against...
We didn't have to buy them, we created them.
Well, that's true, too.
We paid them first in the first place, you know.
Yeah.
I know you still don't believe this 9/11, but, you know, it's just this whole setup. This is actually the source of what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it certainly is.
The very beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm not even sure of the beginning, but it certainly started the latest slide.
Spectacular beginning.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Whether or not we...
Well, thank you. Well, I never expected that will ever happen. You agree with me?
I do agree with you, except I'm an optimist. And
no,
you know
it's
what
just
happens?
When people started paying attention.
The thing is what happened...
Well, I'm an optimist, too. I wake up
every
morning.
Oh, yeah, I can tell.
What do they want from me?
Listen, you know what happens to optimists? When optimists spill their glasses of water, they make a much bigger mess than pessimists. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So where's the Canadian money gone?
Where has the Canadian money gone?
I don't know. According to our fearless leader, Harpernomics suggests that the Canadian economy is sound and strong.
Well, apparently we have more regulations in place, but
Yeah, that's what we heard in the U.S., didn't we?
Yeah. We wait and see.
Do you know how much it costs every day to get this bloody Afghanistan going?
Say that again?
How much does it cost every day to get Afghanistan going?
Well, I know that the Canadians have spent $8 billion so far. So whatever that, if you divide by however...
Well, you mean since they invaded the place?
Yes, since they went in there, yes. So what? Well, so you do the math.
So, well, that basically would cover every single student in this country.
Oh,
get
yeah.
a free education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who cares, right?
Yeah, they just go surfing.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you. Totally with you on that, Marion. I cannot disagree. I'm totally with you. We're pouring money into Afghanistan with only one purpose, and that's pushing pipelines through that avoid Iran and avoid Russia. And it totally is business as usual for the oil guys.
No.
And it's evil.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I think so.
It can't be. That's a conspiracy theory, man.
That's not conspiracy. It's broad. It's out there.
Okay, well... Peace.
Peace. Out. This is no conspiracy theory. This is obvious. This is what's happening. It's like the war in Afghanistan and Iraq is going just very well. It's costing the taxpayers billions and billions of dollars. Canadians still think we're the good guys. But really, we're just bashing our way through countries so that we can lay our oil pipes in. I'm going to take another phone call. That's an opinion, by the way, not news. That was an opinion. Hey, caller, are you there?
This is not another phone call. It's the same caller.
What's up, Marion?
Well, you've been ironic or you've been sarcastic with this conspiracy theory, or are you just putting me on?
I don't think it's a conspiracy theory.
I don't think they're smart enough for it to be a conspiracy.
I was sarcastic.
I don't think it's conspiracy. I just
think if there's enough incompetence spread over enough places that it just looks like a conspiracy.
It's businessmen doing their best to make money, off the blood of other people. I don't think it's conspiracy.
Yeah, get rich quick. Get very rich very quickly.
Yeah, it's ruthless business.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Yeah, so this is Marion, who has a show called The Misery Hour, and he calls himself an optimist.
Absolutely.
I love that. That's
this
great.
This one is for Marion. This is from a site called The Daily Mash. All your hopes and dreams were shattered by bastard Americans last night, just as you expected they always will be. Along with 6 billion other humans, you were forced to rethink your life plan as one set of bastards rejected a bailout for another set of bastards because they were worried about losing their seats when a third set of bastards goes to the polls in November. Emma Bradford, an office manager from Luton, said, "Whenever things were going well, there was always this voice in the back of my mind saying, make the most of it because sooner or later it's all going to be completely fucked by some bastard Americans. I just assumed I'd be horribly maimed as a knock-on from one of their insane catastrophic wars. But instead, they have, in the most beautifully coordinated fashion, demolished the system that provides me with a job, a home, and a vague hope that my life may soon not be an elaborate waste of time."
We've got another call here. Adam, do you want to take it?
Sure. What, instead of doing silly accents? Hey, caller, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Speak to us. This is the end of the world news.
Hey, I just wanted to try and bring us on topic. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Okay.
About the whole financial crisis in the United States.
You speak. We'll listen.
I don't know. I find this weird demonization of people like Warren Buffett, like, a little bit strange. Because, I mean, yes, he's getting a fantastic sort of fire sale deal on all of these stocks and whatnot, with examples like GE, Goldman Sachs. But in the absence of people like him, the businesses would go tits up. You know, like, that's the end. It's over. You know, shareholders aren't going to be kind of screwed in that sort of situation. They're going to be completely out. You know, there's going to be nothing left of the company. And so any sort of fire sale deals that are going in his direction, that situation is better for the shareholders than a complete eradication of the company they own.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a valid point, and I think we're caught between two things, because on the one hand, yeah, you're absolutely right, we need them to buoy up the system, but on the other hand, the system seems to be very, very firmly fixed in favor of the people who are supposedly helping us out by buoying up the system. And the American taxpayer, and I suspect ultimately the Canadian taxpayer, will be left holding the bill when things do go south. Really, our point is that not to demonize Warren Buffett, but to say that there's something behind this that is not philanthropy. It's greed.
Well, no, of course it's not philanthropy. It's free market capitalism, and that's not necessarily bad in this particular case, right? Like,
for whom?
A system which, you know, a bunch of people tried to make money, and they succeed or fail. And if they succeed, then all those shareholders, which include, you know, really rich people and really poor people, you know, make a whole bunch of money. And if it fails, then they're all out. Mm-hmm. Right? And Warren Buffett, just because he has more money, is engaged in the exact same sort of behavior.
Sure.
Right? Like, and so when he's investing in these companies like Goldman Sachs and GE, you know, I agree with you. I totally think that, you know, in a couple of years, these companies will be fine. And I'm pretty sure that's what Buffett's thinking as well.
And the premium...
But, like, he's still, it's the same thing. He's putting his money on the line, and if those companies do go south, like in sort of like a Freddie Mae, like Fannie Mae, you know, totally unsalvageable situation, then he's out those billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. How about, I agree, it's not philanthropy, and I think anyone who's trying to spin it that way is... frankly, yep. Selling something.
We're not talking about my principal complaint is purely ethical, and it's about greed, and I don't think greed is sustainable on this planet in any form. And right now, capitalism as it stands is based on greed, and it's based on the greed of the people running the government, making sure that the risk is taken by the taxpayer and not them.
Well, the fix is
in. I don't mean to poke at the whole Buffett issue. It's just interesting that you brought him up. I mean, you're talking that, like, your main primary complaint seems to be greed, and yet, as an example of sort of like talking about this situation, you bring up Buffett, which is a man who lives off of a salary of $100,000 a year, you know, which is the lowest salary out of any CEO in the North American world, and
true,
like in the Western world, for that matter,
mm-hmm,
right? And a man who probably gives more money to charity than anyone but Bill Gates,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, so to claim that sort of like a lot of, like, I mean, yeah. Sure,
I think you're slightly misunderstanding.
Out for greed, like situations where you've got Dick Cheney's company doing subcontracting in Iraq, that's just gross, right? Like,
mm-hmm,
there's people who are suffering and he's making a buttload of money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
But dragging Buffett into it, it was a strange call, that's all.
Yeah, no, don't misunderstand. I'm not here to demonize Warren Buffett. I'm here to say that if General Electric is giving away its shares to Warren Buffett at this kind of preferred margin, then General Electric is, and as a result, the American economy, is in much bigger shit than they're yet admitting. That's my point.
I don't know. I think everyone's kind of talking about this as sort of the potential lead up to the next Great Depression. I don't think people are trying to soften this in the media. I mean, it's getting more coverage than the presidential election, and how soon is that, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough. But I take your point. Probably Warren Buffett is a lovely man, and probably the bailout, the $70 billion bailout from the states, et cetera, is going to help in the long, or in at least the short term, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the alternative, if Warren Buffett doesn't pump money in, is catastrophic. But that doesn't just mean to say that we should roll over and say, what a lovely fellow.
Well, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, I don't think necessarily that whole sellout situation is necessarily bad, though. And I'm not trying to argue that Warren Buffett is this amazing guy who's really nice. You know, I think he's a pretty amazing person from a business perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that his decisions are, you know, capitalist-minded. You know, he is intending to turn profit on all of these decisions he's making. I don't know. I guess I don't necessarily see the problem with, you know, trying to make money inherently. I don't see there's a problem there. I can totally with you if there's like issues of ethics involved, like things like, you know, private military corporations, like, oh, that's really dodgy, right, from an ethics perspective. But purely making money, I can't really see why that's inherently evil.
It's the equivalent of somebody coming to Thanksgiving dinner at your house and taking half the turkey, putting it on its plate, burping and saying, I'm done. It's pigging out at the banquet. It's taking more than your fair share. And in a planet that is between 6 and 7 billion people and suffering under it, that is becoming a huge problem.
But these large, you know, multi-billion, you know, dollar companies and individuals are the backbone of people's jobs, which gives them that turkey, right? Like, it's not like a guy wandering into a
No, jobs
buffet.
Don't give people turkey. That I think, is the grand illusion. We don't get turkey because we have jobs. We're in a situation...
Yes, we do.
Well, we get turkey because we grow turkeys. We've just been told not to grow our own turkeys because they'd rather sell us theirs.
Yeah, but that's because that whole situation is more efficient. If you want to go back to sort of some sort of sustainable like subsistence agriculture situation, there are places on the planet where you can do that. You're just really poor. People are really used to not being really poor here, and they don't want to be.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's a very good point. And that's our own greed. I'm not just saying this is Warren Buffett's greed. I think we as a society have become increasingly greedy, and I include myself. We have very high expectations, and it's not without cost. That's my only point.
That wealth that we've, you know, generated has paved the way for things like women's suffrage and, you know, like in our country at least, universal health care and, you know, longer lives and better lives, right? Like, I don't know.
Well, I'm
like
with you.
Without this sort of, you know, capitalist, you know, machine, I don't really understand how we could generate the kind of wealth that creates, you know, what we all feel to be good human life.
You have put your finger on the central, complex, difficult point we have to sort out right now if we're going to survive. I think you put your finger on it. It's absolutely true. How are we going to carry on having a lovely life and woman's suffrage and universal health care without having greedy bastards leading the charge? I understand. It's a problem. And I'm with you. I don't have a simple solution. I'm just having a look at the optics, having a look at the way, what's maybe going on behind the veil. That's all we're looking for. But I totally appreciate your point. I think it's completely valid. And we will not demonize anybody anymore, but I will keep on doing silly voices.
Excellent.
Yes.
All right, great show. I'll go back to listening now.
Okay, thanks for the call. Peace out.
Great call.
I think he had a very good point.
Okay, I got to say something, though.
Go on, Graham, go.
Here's the deal, and it is based on a lot of what our caller just had to say. One of the things that we talked about is, you know, philanthropy, and of course Warren Buffett has given, you know, millions, billions. You know, he gave a whole bunch of money to the Gates Foundation, et cetera, et cetera. But here's my central point is that the system over, you know, X number of years has grown up, certainly in the United States, that they have their social compact is that. You know, a fairly free form of capitalism and let the market rule, et cetera, et cetera. And the social compact, say, in Canada is somewhere between that of the Scandinavian countries and the United States. So we're some kind of hybrid. And then you look at the Scandinavian countries where they don't have to have as much philanthropy. People don't have to be magnanimous and give big cocktail parties so they can give away money with the cameras rolling. Their society helps the poor by definition. And I know that's broad strokes, but you see what I'm saying here? That all these Texas oil billionaires and guys who build, you know, bombs that blow up little brown people in other countries, they feel really good when they write a check for a couple of hundred grand so some poor slob of an artist can hang his painting somewhere or some revitalization project in inner city Houston or something like that. But the fact of the matter is that the reason that all these people feel so great is because the system has allowed them to get so goddamn rich that they can give away their money without real consequence. And they have wings of hospitals named after them, and they become heroes.
And they don't have to pay tax on it.
There is the pure business side of things. Mm-hmm. Is that there is to some extent quite a big incentive to give away money.
There is this problem, and the caller points it out, that actually our lives are at least on paper better than they were even 30 years ago, partly because of, you know, medical advances and hygiene advances and mechanical advances. And there is this feeling that life has improved. But it's almost like it becomes so yin, it turns to yang. Our lives have improved so much, they're about to self-destruct. It's almost
Because the age of increasing expectations may well be over. people are going to be hunkering down a bit, I suspect.
But increasing expectations seems to be part of human nature.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
And when we don't, when things don't get better, we just have social revolutions and behead the king.
You know, to bring it on home, there's a lot of pontificating from on high as to how badly, you know, we're going to be affected. We on the Svelte Coast.
It's us and them.
We in Vancouver, as you call it. you know, the housing market, for example, has really, you know, burped lately. And
well, we built a lot of new condos.
But 40,000 people show up in the Lower Mainland every year in British Columbia. So there is a built-in expectation of growth and of new towers going up and new businesses opening and new consumption and new demand for things here in the Lower Mainland. Mm-hmm. So there's this debate now as to how badly the spillover from, you know, Eastern Canada being the manufacturing center, and Ontario and Quebec have taken a much bigger hit than we have here. Even Calgary.
But let's look what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is the essential idea that a home is something to profit from.
Well, certainly that was the assumption in the United States before the bottom fell out.
And we make this assumption in Vancouver that homes are investments. We don't buy homes to live in. We no longer build our own houses. We buy them. And we don't buy them to live in. We buy them because we expect them to go up by 15% a year. Yep. So that we don't... Yeah, and there's something insane about that.
But that has been true for a while. The facts of the matter. The fact is that housing prices in the Lower Mainland and in the Okanagan and in Victoria have been going up. So over a 7 or 9 year period up until really the last 8 months or so, there has been this 10 and 15 and 20% increase. In Saskatchewan, in Regina, it was like 57% last
year. But don't you think that it's doing something critical to our spirit in that we no longer go home? Because we no longer go home because it's where our heart or our family or our love is kept. We go home because it's our investment. And we're kind of trading our family life for an investment. And I personally know of marriages that break up because of the pressure of the mortgage. Yeah. And you kind of go, well, that's because you turned your home into a bank vault and tried to store up your earthly treasure in it instead of storing up your heavenly treasure in your home by loving your family,
Your home.
I just think we've
you're
gone...
You're a goddamn commie socialist, but
that's
you're
true.
A pretty deep guy.
We've gone a little insane trying to turn our homes into gold, I think. Yeah. It's craziness.
True. And maybe certainly here in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland more than a lot of other places. And that has been the psychology. There was this, getting back to what we were talking about with the subprime mortgages and all these weird, four steps removed from your investment in your house, and I use the word investment, you know, no money down. You know, I heard some anecdotal stories about basically people were just, you know, they were writing these deals metaphorically on the back of table napkins and basically, hey, do you have are you employed? Yeah. Okay, here you go. Here's 400 grand.
They were talking about when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac went down, they were talking about making a rule that people would have to put up at least a 5% down payment.
Well, interestingly
That's
enough.
5%? That's...
Interestingly enough, Harper, at the federal level, up until quite recently, he wanted these zero down mortgages, and he backed off all the way to 5%. And instead of 40 years, the limit in Canada is 35 years. But that's a huge amortization period for your equity. You are giving a lot of money over the years. If you look at the eighth wonder of the world is interest and compound interest, and you look at it, and it's amazing how little principal you're giving up each month when you have that kind of amortization period. It's like a few dollars at the beginning of a 35-year or 40-year mortgage. That's your little math.
There you go. Yeah. I'd like to move on from the crumbling economy because everybody else is going to talk about it ad nauseum.
True.
And you know what? There's other things going on in the world. Kind of interesting.
not if you're looking at the American
networks. Yeah, there's nothing but Sarah Palin and
the crumbling. There's the train wreck going on tonight.
Yeah, I'm going to watch that.
Palin and Biden are going to duke it out tonight.
It should be fun. I wish some of them would tell the truth just for once. It would be really nice instead of trying to score points.
Outhouse, I can see Russia.
Just stop playing the optics and just tell us the truth, for God's sakes, which I think is the only thing that can really
really kind of pull us out of this cycle of distrust that has led to the economic decline is that we don't trust nobody anymore. We certainly don't trust our leaders to tell the truth. Tony Blair said it the other day. He was on the Jon Stewart show, on The Daily Show, and Jon Stewart said, you know, why did you believe Bush? And Blair said, if you're talking to a world leader, you have to trust him. You have to believe he means what he says. He is a world leader. If we start second-guessing all of these people, we have no ground to stand on. And I had a small amount of sympathy with that point, but I think it was disingenuous. I mean, I think really he was dodging a bullet. But you kind of go, well, yeah, I can see the wisdom of that, that you do kind of at the highest level have to believe that these guys are telling the truth. And I think he was lied to. But in the meantime, wonderful things are happening down with Chavez in Venezuela. Chavez has been kicking out the Americans. The Americans have been kicking out Chavez. Things have been deteriorating a great deal. Russian ships.
Four Russian warships will take part in joint exercises with Venezuela later this year. Venezuelan government said this week, it will be first Russian presence in Caribbean since Cold War. The announcement came just week after Prime Minister now, Vladimir Palin, I say. It's very funny. Palin, Putin. Oh, you think this is conspiracy? Vladimir Putin said his country would respond to U.S. deployment of warships in Black Sea. Traditionally Russian Navy haunt to deliver humanitarian aid to Georgia. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez predicted U.S. disapproval, saying, go ahead and squeal, Yankees. But you...
but you really say that?
Yeah. Go ahead and squeal, Yankees.
This isn't an atomism.
No. This is a quote. And okay. I quote Chavez, go ahead and squeal, Yankees. But U.S. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick said only that it was interesting that the Russians had found a few ships that can make it that far.
In other words,
the Americans are being idiots and just saying, oh, yeah, we don't care. So the Americans are putting their ships in the Black Sea, and the Russians are putting their ships in the Caribbean, and we're all looking the other way.
I feel so nostalgic, warm and fuzzy for the Cold War.
There's an oxymoron there. Meanwhile, President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and Evo Morales of Bolivia expelled U.S. ambassadors from their countries. Mm. This is 2 weeks ago. Two Russian strategic bombers landed in Venezuela as part of military maneuvers. The arrival of the Russian warplanes followed a statement by the Venezuelan government that four Russian ships would participate in joint exercise in the Caribbean. Yeah, exactly. Chavez accused Washington of fomenting a coup attempt against his socialist revolution. Also, he threatened to cut oil supplies to the state. Such a move would disrupt the U.S. economy, but it would also devastate Venezuela's economy. And this is here. Here's what Chavez says, quoted, this is not in the American press, but in the British press, they quote him as saying, go to hell 100 times, fucking Yankees.
That's a world leader.
That's a quote, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting how on paper, the sworn enemy of the United States, Venezuela, supplies some percentage of the oil to keep the Northeast warm in the winter. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a huge percentage of Russian oil and natural gas ends up in Western Europe.
Uh-huh.
And so, for example, when Russia and Putin went into Abkhazia and South Ossetia 8 weeks ago, the impotence of what really the Western leaders as well as the United States could do to slap the wrist of the Russian bear was there for all to see. Mm-hmm. They were caught with their pants. And the fact of the matter is there was nothing they could do because they're caught now. So this nominal sworn enemy is also – they're the ones that keep us warm at night, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I mean, I'm of two minds. One is, well, in the end, we really can't be enemies because, of course – they're selling it because they want the money. We're buying it because we need the oil on the simplest of levels. So how can we be enemies? So it's kind of a weird chess game. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's carry on down these lines because Chavez has been on an arms buying spree and he has proposed a hemispheric South American Defense Council aimed at the United States, and you know darn well that the America, France, England is going to be selling Chavez his arms as well. So not only are we buying his oil, but he's buying our arms, and we're back to we're back to this concept of conspiracy theory, which I actually don't believe it's a conspiracy. It's what the other caller called capitalism, business as usual. Mm-hmm. And I say it's just profit-making.
It's just a whole bunch of guys doing their individual deals, and it just looks so nasty and ugly that it looks like a conspiracy, but I don't think it is. Now, speaking of arms, have you heard what's been happening off the Somalian coast?
Oh, tell me about the Somalian coast.
An 1,800-mile Somalian rough coast.
Yeah, yeah, where the pirates
are.
Well,
the pirates are there. You know, right near the, you know, just south of the Strait of Hormuz, where 40% of Europe's oil ends up, you know, goes through every day. Mm-hmm. These pirates, somewhere between 20 and 50 of them, seized a ship. And that's just business as usual. They usually demand a ransom. Mm-hmm. You know.
This time it was $35 million or
something?
They
started with 35. They've gone down, I've heard, as low as 5 now. Because the problem is they're negotiating. And the four U.S. naval vessels have now surrounded the ship. And normally they wouldn't care, you know. Like, it's just business as usual. Just greasing a few palms here and there to keep the products flowing. But this ship, which was out of Ukraine, contained a whole bunch of tanks, military tanks. Mm-hmm. And one of the many sort of subplots is that nobody's entirely sure where they were going.
Yeah.
So these hapless 20 to 50, you know, probably illiterate, poor guys with guns just trying to make some money are sitting on all these military weaponry. Uh-huh. And so all of a sudden they go, and they're swearing, you know, up and down. Apparently,
they were just hijacking a boat, hoping to pick up some.
They were hijacking a boat. They claim they didn't know anything about what was really on it. And a New York Times reporter based out of Europe somewhere, or no, based out of Africa, I think Nairobi, Kenya or something, he got a hold of these guys finally. Like, he spoke to them for 45 minutes. And he's saying that they really didn't, you know, they're claiming
They didn't know
what was on them.
Yeah,
but they're very brave. At least on the surface, they still want to negotiate, even though the American military is now circling. And it's a very, because they don't want to blow up all this hardware, and they don't want to kill their something like 18 or 20 hostages. You know, the crew of the ship. So it's
and
just,
how convenient to have a good excuse to have all your military warships circling around just below the Gulf of Hormuz, where Iran is sending its oil out of.
But the fact is that there's this subplot, and I suppose it will come out. Where the hell were these tanks all going to? I mean, this was serious military hardware.
Interesting.
And
a lot of
things that blow up too. So they can't just kind of disable the ship because they might blow it up. So there's a real end game there.
Yeah, there really is. Well, I mean, here's a little story that is separate from that, but it's all part of the same shell game that I thought was very interesting. Secret U.S. assassination program, not the U.S. troop surge, is largely behind the dramatic drop in violence in Iraq. There's a claim by Bob Woodward in a new book. And he says that, and what has happened, the Bush administration claims the cooperation with the Sunnis in Anbar has caused the drop. But Bob Woodward says actually there's
meaning
been,
we pay them.
Yeah, but he says actually not only have we been paying them, there have been secret targeted assassinations going on for a couple of years, and that's what's made the large difference. Which, of course, is illegal under international law.
Yep.
You know, you can't go around. But the karma of this is going to play out with, you know, secret assassinations of world leaders for hundreds of years to come. It used to be off limits. It used to be against the Geneva Convention. And now, ever since, we've been gunning for Saddam, you know, chasing them out of their hidey holes, etc.
I saw Bob Woodward.
35 years, by the way, since we went into Chile and assassinated Allende, who was, a popular socialist leader and placed
CIA-backed
Pinochet. That's 35 years ago now. And look the world. Look at the karma of that little thing has turned it to Chavez. And
it was fascinating watching a couple of interviews and hearing an interview on the radio with Bob Woodward as he was promoting his book, which had these revelations in it. And quite directly, he was asked, you know, some quite specific questions about how these assassinations were taking place. And he said, "No, I cannot say." And his reasoning was, it would actually put a whole lot of people, Americans, in danger. I mean, that is his claim, is that he knows a whole lot of things that he just cannot reveal.
That classic, I'd tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Yeah,
Pretty much. Yeah, he almost turned white when he was forcefully asked about that. It was a real pregnant pause in the conversation. So I find that quite fascinating. And it's fascinating for any number of points of view. You can look upon it as just the horrid realism of covert operations and that kind of thing. And it also puts a bit of a lie, if indeed he is to be believed, as to whether the surge really worked. So, you know, these 30 or 40, it is kind of received wisdom, at least in many circles, even Obama's, you know, having to let on, well, yes, the surge is kind of working, but maybe it's not. I can look upon another way to read the situation is that the Al-Qaeda networks and the Sunnis over in Iraq are saying, oh, well, it's becoming politically distasteful on all sides in the United States to stay in Iraq, so we'll just back off and wait.
Mm-hmm.
I really do think that's what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah, just wait and take over. Yeah, they have patience. They have patience.
Or just resume things when the troops really start getting out.
I agree.
Yeah.
We've got just a couple of minutes left before Charlie comes in to sweeten your morning with hot jazz from the last Great Depression.
hey, some good music came
but
out of
first,
it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And some great art will come out of this Great Depression. There's nothing like everybody else getting poor feel better.
Yeah, that's if we could afford the crayons.
Oh, well, we can always paint with our own blood. And if that runs out, we can use the bullshit that gets fed down to us from above.
I can't wait.
But here, a good week for myth-making. Russian media praised Prime Minister Vladimir Putin for saving a television crew from an attack by a Siberian tiger. Putin calmly brought the fierce Siberian tiger down with one perfectly aimed shot from tranquilizer gun.
So,
isn't
the
that a
hero himself,
story? Putin.
He
was saved,
just happened to be in the neighborhood?
This is absolute proof that Putin is in favor of a free press because he killed Siberian tiger
with his own tranquilizer gun. You say it was just a tranquilizer
gun. Just tranquilizer gun, yeah.
It wouldn't
saved
have looked as good if he'd splattered the brains of this,
story,
of this rare tiger all over the front pages of the newspapers. So he just calmly just put him to sleep.
Yeah. Other side of the world, India. The Bollywood has gone on strike. There is strike in Bollywood. I know, it's terrible. Strike in Bollywood. Everyone out of work. Only yesterday, but listen to this.
Don't they have the biggest film industry in the world?
Yeah. A film worker gets 600 rupees per day, which is about maybe 10 bucks.
Okay.
A television worker gets 500, which is maybe about 7 or 8 bucks a day.
Okay.
That's the hitting the big time in Bollywood. Oh. And so they're going on strike saying, you know what? I have seen pictures from Hollywood, and they get paid substantially more. So Bollywood's on strike, and it's a bad week for Bollywood because Warner Brothers is threatening to sue a Bollywood movie called Hari Putar. Munish Puri said, Hari is a common Indian name. Putar means son. We are not trying to exploit the success of Harry Potter by calling our movie Harry Potter. But
I believe him. It was purely coincidental.
Harry Potter. And one more
apparently
story.
It's an excrementitiously bad movie, so.
One with Harry Potter?
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter. One more story. This comes from England, where they're trying to stop people smoking. Smokers are to be forced to walk around wearing their lungs on their head under new government rules. Cigarette packets must now carry a picture of a troll. The lung hat will be connected to the smokers via a series of tubes shoved directly into their nostrils. As the lungs will cover the ears, holes will be drilled in each side so the smokers are still able to hear the criticism of their friends and colleagues. Meanwhile, once a month, council officials will strap the smokers to a chair, pluck the beating heart from their chest and shove it in their faces, shouting, well, you happy? Public Health Minister Dawn Primarolo said, not only do I want smokers to come face to face with their own lungs, I want everyone else, especially children, to point to them and scream. Who in their right mind will want to sit next to a smoker and his wheezing, unsightly flesh helmet? She added, young smokers may think it's clever to walk around parading their flesh pink lungs at a jaunty angle, but it won't be long before they look like a giant, disgusting fly, just like Jeff Goldblum in that film. Bill Mackay, a smoker from Harrogate, said,
this is actually very useful. I had no idea that the smoke was going into my lungs. I thought it went straight out my back passage, like an exhaust pipe.
Well,
this is the end of the end of the end of the world news, and here comes Charlie to sweeten your day with hot jazz. Graham, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Your presence has edified the world, Adam.
And to all you listeners out there, if you're a smoker, get those lungs on your head. Here's one final minute from Mexico and the Pinkertones before Charlie sweetens the day. Peace out.
It is 89.9 KCRW, just about 20 minutes after 11. All right, throw it over to you guys. It's the Pinkertones on Morning Becomes Eclectic.
Whoa.